Chapter 48, Academic Interlude. The Benares Hindu University campus was several square miles in extent and crisscrossed by broad, tree-lined avenues, along which plied a small army of brightly painted cycle rickshaws. Some distance behind the trees, and usually at considerable intervals, rose the red sandstone blocks of the university buildings, all of them in the neo-Hindu style of architecture, and all of enormous size. Buddhakuti, Bhikkhu Jagdish Kashyap's modest two-story residence, was situated in a quiet corner just inside the perimeter wall, not far from the university post office, and several miles from the red sandstone splendours of the main entrance. Buddharakshita and I had not been long in Benares before we went to pay our respects to our kind adviser and inform him of the successful outcome of our mission to Kusinara. We were staying, not very happily, at the Burmese rest house in the city, where the two harsh-voiced, rough-mannered Burmese monks jeered at us for being vegetarians. "Not eat meat," they exclaimed angrily. "You must eat meat. If you don't eat meat, you're not Buddhists. You're Hindus." Though the rainy season was now well advanced, we were still no nearer to finding a place in which to spend the rain's residence than we had been in Nepal. Buddharakshita was strongly in favour of our making another attempt to enter Ceylon, where we would be able to study and where we could take the higher ordination. Partly because I was without means of identification, and partly because I did not feel well enough to embark on further wanderings, I was against this plan. It was Bhikkhu Kashyap who resolved the dilemma. With characteristic generosity, he made it clear that, if it would be of any use, there was room for one of us at Buddhakuti, but only for one, and that he would be happy to provide not only board and lodging, but instruction. This, of course, meant the end of the partnership between Buddharakshita and myself, which had now lasted uninterruptedly for 2.5 years. After prolonged discussion, my impetuous friend suddenly announced that his mind was made up. He would go to Ceylon. I should stay in Benares with Bhikkhu Kashyap. Since I was unfit to travel and needed a bit of looking after, this was clearly the best arrangement. In any case, he added, unable to resist a parting shot, it was me that Bhikkhu Kashyap wanted as a disciple, not him. Within 24 hours, I had moved into Buddhakuti, and Buddharakshita was on his way to Calcutta. Though I was sorry to lose my warm-hearted but irascible companion, once the actual parting was over, my predominant feeling was one of relief. Living with Buddharakshita had at times been a nightmare, and it was only now as I was once more on my own that I realised how great the strain had been. True, since our ordination he had been easy to get on with. The deference and submissiveness of the Niwas had been as balm to his soul, and seeing him better tempered than he had been for a long time, I had begun to entertain hopes that the demon by which he was periodically afflicted had been permanently exorcised. These hopes were soon shattered. While we were at the Padmagarbha Vihara, there arrived in Bhutal a young Niwar monk who had just spent 2 years in Ceylon. Not content with exhibiting his accomplishments to an admiring circle of friends and relations, and covering the walls of the Vihara with the Sinhalese posters of all the lectures he had given, he tried to treat Buddharakshita and me as he thought newly ordained shamaneras ought to be treated by a fully ordained monk who had just spent 2 years in the very citadel of orthodoxy. Buddharakshita bore it for a couple of days. Then, after an altercation which did credit neither to him nor to his antagonist, he exploded. The young monk's grandmother did her best to assuage my friend's wrath. "Take no notice of him," she confided. "He's the fool of the family. We only sent him to Ceylon to become a monk because he wasn't bright enough to be of much use in the family business." But the damage had been done. The demon was back. Yet despite the tensions of our life together and my relief at finding myself once more on my own, I was far from failing to appreciate the many sterling qualities that Buddharakshita undoubtedly possessed. But for him, I might never have spent 2 years as a wandering ascetic, might never have made the difficult transition from the old way of life to the new, and for that I was deeply grateful. In less than a week, I was feeling perfectly at home in my new surroundings, and had embarked on a course of study that was to keep me busy, almost without interruption, for 7 of the quietest and happiest months I have ever known. Life at Buddhakuti was simple in the extreme, and there were no distractions. Apart from a bookcase filled ceiling-high with books, my room contained only a string bed, a table, and a chair. Bhikkhu Kashyap's room, which was next door and communicated with mine, contained no more, not even a piece of carpet on the floor or a picture on the wall. As I soon realized, it was not that my new preceptor attached any special importance to asceticism. He simply did not bother with material things. Except for 2 or 3 students reading Pali for their BA, who came once a week, there were no visitors, and even the married nephew, who lived downstairs, was rarely seen or heard. Other than Bhikkhu Kashyap, the only person with whom I had any contact was the servant, a thinner, darker, less sprightly version of Shankara Pillai, who had the distinction of being the illegitimate son of a Sinhalese monk. Our day began at dawn. After we had breakfasted on tea and toast, the latter saturated with ghee and sprinkled with sugar, I read Pali, Abhidhamma and Logic with Bhikkhu Kashyap, then returned to my room and did the exercises he had set me. This kept me busy until noon, when we had the usual rice and curry lunch. Bhikkhu Kashyap, mindful of the Indian equivalent of an apple a day keeps the doctor away, always rounded off the meal by chewing a couple of cloves of raw garlic. In the afternoon, having enjoyed a brief siesta, I either studied on my own, referring to my teacher occasionally if necessary, or engaged in literary work. When it was dusk, Bhikkhu Kashyap took his stick and we went for a walk. Every time we drew abreast of one of the big margosa trees that lined the broad avenues through which we passed, I was struck by a strong current of vitality. Perhaps it was only the sun's heat radiating from the rough grey trunks, but I could not help feeling that the trees were alive, even as I was alive, that they were living presences, almost personalities. The first time he went out, Bhikkhu Kashyap confessed that only a year ago he was so fat that he could not walk. If he tried to do so, the insides of his thighs chafed so badly that he bled. For the last year, however, he had been following naturopathy, and having succeeded in reducing his weight by about a third, was now a firm believer in that system of medicine. A few weeks later, when I fell ill with jaundice, he persuaded me to follow naturopathy too. On our return to Buddhakuti, I took a glass of hot milk, strictly speaking against the rules, but Bhikkhu Kashyap insisted, and carried on with my studies. At 10 or 11 o'clock, I paid my respects to my teacher in the traditional manner, asking forgiveness for whatever offences I might have committed in the course of the day, and retired for the night to my string bed. The 3 subjects that I read with Bhikkhu Kashyap, or Kashyapji, as he was generally known, were all quite new to me, and I cultivated them with varying degrees of success. Not having much of a gift for languages, I had the greatest difficulty with Pali, the ancient Indian language in which the Theravada redaction of the Buddha's teaching had been preserved. According to Kashyapji, who besides being trained in Western academic disciplines, was a pandit of the old type, and had learned everything by heart at an early age, Pali grammar was child's play, and he did his best to encourage me with the reminder that in Pali there were only 700 rules, whereas Sanskrit had 3,000. I was far from finding Pali child's play. Though I did my exercises every day and committed to memory long lists of conjugations and declensions, I did so with grim determination, rather than with the gay abandon that Kashyapji seemed to think appropriate to the subject. Sometimes I felt dull and bored. Luckily, my teacher was not one of those who believe that you first have to learn the grammar of a language thoroughly before being allowed to look at a text. And before many weeks had passed, I had been introduced to the Tipitaka. Some of its books were composed in ridiculously simple Pali, explained Kashyapji, and a smattering of grammar was all that was needed to understand them. Starting with these books and progressing gradually to others more difficult, one could easily get through the 45 volumes of the Royal Thai edition of the Tipitaka in a 12-month. Why, it was not even a volume a week. Though I did not live up to these expectations, and though my knowledge of Pali never went much beyond the smattering necessary to carry me through such works as the Dhammapada and the Udana, the delight of being able to study the Buddha's teaching in what many Buddhists believe were his own words more than compensated for the difficulties of learning the language in which it had been imparted. With both Abhidharma and logic, I fared rather better, especially with logic. Though in my early and middle teens I had read quite widely in philosophy, for some reason or other I had completely neglected this ancient and venerable partner of metaphysics, ethics, politics, aesthetics, and rhetoric. It was therefore with some trepidation that I set about making good the omission. But I need not have worried. Once I had emerged from the thorny thickets of formal logic, I found myself in one of the most fascinating and enjoyable stretches of the intellectual terrain in which it had ever been my lot to wander, and with companions among the most delightful it had ever been my good fortune to meet. Bradley, admittedly, was a little forbidding, but Mill and Carvath Reed I found exhilarating in the extreme, while F.C.S. Schiller's Formal Logic, a radical empiricist's brilliant exposure of the aridities and absurdities of the subject, as traditionally expounded, was undoubtedly one of the most hilarious books I had ever encountered. While I was reading it, there escaped from me from time to time chuckles, even guffaws, which Kashyapji, in his room next door, never heard when I was studying Pali. However conventional Kashyapji's teaching methods might have been, his manner of teaching was unconventional enough. When I entered his room, the communicating door was always left open. It was generally to find him stretched out on his string bed like a stranded whale, sound asleep. For although he could work day and night when necessary, he could sleep day and night too with equal ease. As professor of Pali and Buddhist philosophy, his duties were minimal, and much of his time was therefore spent on the string bed, which creaked protestingly from time to time, and where he slept without benefit of either mattress or pillow. On my coughing or murmuring Bante, a single eyelid would twitch, whereupon I would put my question, which was generally on some knotty point of Pali grammar or Abhidharma or logic, which I had not been able to unravel by myself. Without opening his eyes and without moving, Kashyapji would proceed to clear up the difficulty, heaving the words up from the depths of his enormous frame and rolling them around on his tongue, before releasing them in slow, deliberate utterance. Sometimes he rumbled on for only a few minutes, sometimes for half an hour. Whatever he said was clear, precise, and to the point. If I asked about a particular passage of text, he always knew whereabouts it came, what had come before, and what followed. Yet all the time he had hardly bothered to wake up. As I returned to my room, I would hear behind me a sigh and a snore, and before I had settled down at my table, Kashyapji would be sound asleep again. The intercourse between us was not always of this kind. When not stretched out on the string bed, Kashyapji could be both animated and entertaining, with a pleasant touch of the unsophisticated humour of his Bihari peasant ancestry. Sometimes he spoke about his experiences in Ceylon, where he had studied at the Vidyalankara Pirivenna, where I had seen him at the 1944 convocation, when he came to receive the title of Tripitakacharya, and where he had been ordained. Though he had enjoyed his stay, he did not have a very high opinion of the Sinhalese Buddhists. Monks and lay people alike were narrow-minded and unintelligent. Formalism was rife. Once, when he was returning from his alms round, his robe had come undone, and in order to adjust it, he had put his begging bowl down on a patch of grass. "Just look at the Indian monk," shrieked an old woman who saw him. "Supposed to be a scholar. He doesn't even know how to respect his bowl." According to tradition, begging bowls should never be placed on the bare ground. On another occasion, he was lecturing on the well-known Buddhist doctrine of anatta, literally no self or no soul. In order to understand the meaning of anatta, he had declared, one had first to understand the meaning of atta, self or soul. For unless one knew what particular concept of self or soul the Buddha was negating, how could one possibly know what his teaching of no self or no soul was meant to convey? This was apparently beyond the Sinhalese Buddhists. There were angry shouts of protest from the audience. "We don't want you bringing your Hindu philosophy here," yelled the monks. "Sit down, sit down." In vain Kashyapji tried to explain that it was not his intention to defend the detested atta doctrine. He was not allowed to continue his lecture. Some of his experiences had been of a more amusing kind. Sinhalese monks were always wanting to know which Nikaya or sect of the monastic order he belonged to. "In fact," said Kashyapji, "they were no less inquisitive on this score than Orthodox Hindus were on the subject of caste." His usual reply was that he belonged to Buddha Nikaya. One group of monks, not satisfied with this, had asked him whether he covered his right shoulder with his robe when leaving the monastery, or whether he left it uncovered, the point of the inquiry being that some Nikayas followed one practice, some the other. "When it's cold," Kashyapji had replied, "I cover both shoulders. When it's hot, I keep one shoulder uncovered. And when it's very hot, I don't wear any robe at all." One day, when he had gratefully acknowledged the part played by Ceylon in the preservation of the Pali scriptures, my preceptor delivered himself of his considered opinion of the Sinhalese Buddhists in the following memorable words. "Sangharakshachaji," he said, speaking slowly and deliberately and with evident feeling, "they are a set of monkeys sitting on a treasure, the value of which they do not understand." Much as Kashyapji's anecdotes reflected on the Buddhists of Ceylon, there was nothing in his attitude to suggest either self-righteousness or censoriousness, and he was capable of telling a story against himself with equal relish. Before being appointed professor at Benares Hindu University, he had spent some time in Penang, where there was a large and wealthy Chinese business community and a flourishing Buddhist movement. Whenever he performed his devotions in the magnificent temple they had built, he saluted the image of the Buddha, but, being a Theravadin, he did not salute the images of Kuan Yin and the other attendant bodhisattvas. One day, the Chinese Mahayana Buddhist with whom he was staying gave him for lunch nothing but rice. When Kashyapji, mildly astonished, inquired what had happened to the curries, he was told that the rice was the main thing. "Of course the rice is the main thing," agreed Kashyapji, "but the curries are also necessary." "Just so," retorted his host. "The curries are also necessary, as you say. Similarly, the Buddha is the main thing. No one doubts that. But the bodhisattvas are necessary too." "After this homely lesson," said my teacher, "he was always careful to salute the bodhisattvas." Though Kashyapji definitely preferred the rationalism tinged with mysticism of the Theravada to the mysticism tinged with rationalism of the Mahayana, and though his main interest in life was the revival of Pali studies in India, he was an exceptionally tolerant and open-minded person with a real respect for the right and duty of the individual to think for himself. For him, the born teacher, teaching represented not a process of indoctrination, but a sharing of knowledge, a pooling of intellectual resources. And while he was always ready to answer my questions, he never made the slightest attempt to influence my thinking. On the contrary, in after years, he was fond of maintaining that, in some respects, he had learned as much from me as I had from him. While it was not for me to contradict my preceptor on such a point as this, whatever exchange there might have been between us must have been very unequal, the price of 100 oxen for the price of 9. Besides sharing with me his vast knowledge of the Pali scriptures, especially the Abhidharma, Kashyapji was the means of introducing me to some of the less well-known branches of Indian religious tradition. Among these were Jainism and the heterodox, that is, non-Vedic or even anti-Vedic, post-medieval mysticisms, some of which were believed by scholars to have been continuous with the last phases of Tantric Buddhism. In addition to the texts of my regular trivium, I read with him the Jaina Apabhramsa equivalent of the Dhammapada, with which, as he pointed out, it had a number of verses in common, and a riddling esoteric work by Kabir known as the Bijak. For all members of the Shramana, as distinct from the Brahmana group of Indian religions, Kashyapji indeed had a strong sympathy, a sympathy that was by no means confined to books. On our rare expeditions into Benares, when I accompanied him on visits to Jain monk scholars and Kabir Panthi ascetics, I could see for myself how cordial his relations with them all were, and how much they, on their part, loved and venerated him. As might have been expected, during the whole of my time that I was with him, Kashyapji made no attempt to restrict my freedom, in particular, my freedom to read and write what I pleased. All his books, as well as his ticket to the university library, were at my disposal, and he never questioned the use I made of them. Indeed, it did not seem to occur to him to question it. When not occupied with Pali, Abhidharma, and logic, I therefore read more widely than I had done for several years. As the mood seized me, I also wrote. After being confined to works that I had come across more or less by accident, it was delightful to be able to range at will through all the fields of literature, ancient and modern, eastern and western, sacred and profane. But delightful though it was, such freedom was not without problems of its own. More clearly than ever before, it brought out into the open a conflict in my interests, perhaps a conflict in my nature itself, which the circumstances of my wandering life with Buddharajita had tended to obscure. The nature of this conflict was well illustrated by two letters which I received during the second half of my stay at Buddhakuti. One was from the redoubtable Bhikkhu Soma. He had already taken me very seriously to task for gadding about instead of settling in one place and getting down to serious work. And having seen some of my recent contributions to the Buddhist magazines of Ceylon, he now wrote to put me to rights as regards my literary work. "When I could write such excellent articles on Buddhist philosophy," he demanded, "why did I waste my time writing those foolish poems?" By a strange coincidence, the other letter, which was from a Sinhalese Buddhist laywoman, arrived on the same day and expressed exactly the opposite point of view. "When I could write such beautiful poems on Buddhism," she asked, "why did I spend so much time writing those dry intellectual articles?" The truth of the matter was that I agreed and disagreed with both correspondents. The conflict was not so much between the philosophically minded monk and the poetry loving laywoman, as between Sangharakshita I and Sangharakshita II. Thangarachita I wanted to enjoy the beauty of nature, to read and write poetry, to listen to music, to look at paintings and sculpture, to experience emotion, to lie in bed and dream, to see places, to meet people. Thangarachita II wanted to realize the truth, to read and write philosophy, to observe the precepts, to get up early and meditate, to mortify the flesh, to fast and pray. Sometimes Thangarachita I was victorious, sometimes Thangarachita II, while occasionally there was an uneasy duumvirate. What they ought to have done, of course, was to marry and give birth to Thangarachita III, who would have united beauty and truth, poetry and philosophy, spontaneity and discipline. But this seemed to be a dream impossible of fulfilment. For the last 2.5 years, Thangarachita II had ruled practically unchallenged. Aided and abetted by Buddharachita, who strongly disapproved of poetry, he had in fact sought to finish off Thangarachita I altogether, and but for the timely intervention of Swami Ram Das, who firmly declared that writing poetry was not incompatible with the spiritual life, Thangarachita I might well have died a premature death in Muvattuputsa. However, despite the bludgeoning that he had received, he had not died, and after leading a furtive existence in Nepal, he was now coming into his own again at Buddhakuti. Kashyapji's dealings were, of course, mainly with Thangarachita II, but he had no objection to Thangarachita I being around, and even spoke to him occasionally. Soon, Thangarachita I was feeling strong enough to demand equal rights. If Thangarachita II devoted the afternoon to the path of purity, Thangarachita I spent the evening immersed in the poetry of Matthew Arnold, which for some reason or other exerted a powerful influence during this period. When the former wrote an article on Buddhist philosophy, or edited the second edition of Kashyapji's Buddhism for Everybody, the latter composed poems. Sometimes, while one self was busy copying out extracts from the books he had been reading, the other would look idly out of the window and watch the falling of the rain. One day there was a violent clash between them. Angered by the encroachments of Thangarachita I, who was reading more poetry than ever, and who had written a long poem which, though it had a Buddhist theme, was still a poem, Thangarachita II suddenly burned the 2 notebooks in which his rival had written all the poems he had composed from the time of their departure from England right down to about the middle of their sojourn in Singapore. After this catastrophe, which shocked them both, they learned to respect each other's spheres of influence. Occasionally they even collaborated, as in the completion of the blank verse rendition of the 5 Parichana Sutras that had been started in Nepal. There were even rare moments when it seemed that, despite their quarrels, they might get married one day. Though the months at Buddhakuti passed quickly enough, and though the rainy season ended and winter began without any change in my way of life, I was not so remote from the world, nor so deeply immersed in my studies, as to be altogether beyond the reach of outside influences. To begin with, there were letters from Buddharachita, who, after spending a short time with Bhikkhu Soma, was now staying with the German monks at Dodandua in southern Ceylon. Though he was making good progress with Pali, his Hindu prejudices were evidently receiving a tremendous hammering, and he seemed to be suffering from a species of cultural shock. From within India, there was the news of the fierce and bitter controversy raging around the proposed Hindu code bill, in connection with which I first heard the name of the scheduled castes leader Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, then law minister in the government of India. Owing to the opposition of orthodox Hindu elements within the ruling party itself, the bill was eventually passed only in a fragmented and mutilated form, and in disgust, Ambedkar resigned from the cabinet. In later years, I came to know him personally, and after his death in 1956, was deeply involved in the movement of mass conversion to Buddhism that he had initiated among his untouchable followers. From Benares itself came the news of the arrival of the sacred relics of the arahants Shariputra and Moggallana, the Buddha's two great disciples. After spending 90 years in the Victoria and Albert Museum, they had been returned to India at the beginning of the year, at the request of the Mahabodhi Society, and were now being taken round various parts of India, as well as to some of the Buddhist countries, and exposed for the veneration of the people. Everywhere they went, they had been received with tremendous enthusiasm. In Benares, however, the welcome was comparatively muted. Kashyap Ji and I went and paid our respects to the relics at the Vizianagaram Palace, where we found them enshrined in the throne room on a solid silver chair. To the right of the relics stood a dozen or so yellow-robed monks, among whom I soon detected the gleaming pate and vulture-eyed features of His Holiness from Calcutta. On seeing me, he gave a violent start, and biting his lip, turned away without a word. Finally, only a few weeks before my departure from Benares, there was an unexpected visit from Venerable M. Sangharatana Thera, Secretary of the Mahabodhi Society at Sarnath. A wall had just been built round the Mahabodhi rest house at Bodh Gaya, he announced in his usual voluble fashion. The work had cost 2,000 rupees, and the amount had been donated by one of the richest and most important high priests in the whole of Ceylon. The high priest himself and a dozen other monks were even now at Bodh Gaya. All the week they had been chanting in a special bamboo pavilion constructed inside the hall of the rest house, and in 2 days' time the wall would be solemnly consecrated. He would, of course, have to attend the ceremony and accept the wall on behalf of the Mahabodhi Society. Would I care to accompany him? Though I was not particularly keen on seeing the wall, despite the glowing accounts Venerable Sangharatana gave of it, I was very eager indeed to see Bodh Gaya, the site of the Buddha's supreme enlightenment. Sarnath, Kusinara and Lumbini I had already seen earlier in the year, but Bodh Gaya, the most important of the four great holy places, was as yet unvisited. With Kashyapji's permission, I therefore accepted the invitation our good-hearted friend had so warmly extended. Bodh Gaya, Bodh Gaya, how many people have come to you in the course of ages? How many pilgrim feet have trodden the dust of your groves? How many pairs of hands been joined in silent adoration beneath the wide-spreading boughs of the Tree of Enlightenment? How many heads touched in profound thanksgiving the edge of the Diamond Throne? Bodh Gaya, Bodh Gaya, how beautiful you are in the morning, with the sunlight streaming on the renovated façade of your great temple as it rises foursquare against the cloudless blue sky. How beautiful in the evening, when in the shadowy depths of the deserted temple courtyard, 1,000 votive lamps glitter like reflections of the stars. Bodh Gaya, I shall always remember how beautiful you were the first time I saw you, when my heart was young, and you made me your own. The shrines of Sarnath, Kusinara and Lumbini had all been destroyed in the 12th century, and both the Mula Gandakuti Vihara and the Temple of the Recumbent Buddha had been built in modern times. Since they had been built by Buddhists, their management was naturally in Buddhist hands. At Bodh Gaya, the situation was different. The Mahabodhi Temple, or Temple of the Great Enlightenment, restored by General Sir Alexander Cunningham in 1870, was substantially the one built in the 2nd century on the remains of an earlier Ashokan structure. In the course of 2 millennia, the level of the surrounding countryside had risen by 20 or 30 feet, with the result that the entire temple complex, including the Bodhi tree and the Diamond Throne, now stood in an enormous rectangular well. Until earlier that year, management of the temple had been in the hands of the Hindu Mahant, or abbot of Bodh Gaya, then the second biggest landowner in the state of Bihar, one of whose predecessors had somehow gained possession of it in the 16th century. As an Orthodox Brahmin, the Mahant's main interest was in the offerings of the pilgrims, who in recent centuries had been making their way to Bodh Gaya in ever-increasing numbers. Under an act of the state government, however, management of the temple had now been transferred to a committee. But as the constitution of the committee had been so framed as to ensure a permanent Hindu majority, things were not much better than they had been in the Mahant's time. Images of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas were still being smeared with vermilion, and in a shed-like structure near the main entrance, five of them were being palmed off on a gullible Hindu public as representations of the five Pandava brothers, legendary heroes whose exploits were described in the Mahabharata. To assist the deception, the images had been draped with pieces of dirty cloth so that only their faces were visible. Venerable Sangharatna was furious. "Just like the bloody Hindus," he exploded, tearing the cloths from the images and flinging them violently on the floor. "Always trying to assimilate Buddhism to their own dirty religion. Always trying to get a bit more money out of the stupid pilgrims. Pilgrims, superstitious idiots. They deserve to be robbed." Though rather taken aback by this un-monk-like outburst, I could not help sympathising with Venerable Sangharatna's feelings. As I well knew, he was a personal disciple of Anagarika Dhammapala, and for more than 30 years Dhammapala had tried, without success, to gain for the Buddhists some say in the management of their own most sacred shrine. In the Holy of Holies, a pleasingly simple chamber lit only from the door, it was even worse. A stone lingam, or phallic symbol of the god Shiva, had been let into the middle of the floor in front of the offering table, just where one was likely to trip over it in the semi-darkness. Long-legged Brahmins clambered like monkeys all over the altar, passing backwards and forwards in front of the great sedent image of the Buddha, and vociferously insisted on doing the pilgrims' worshipping for him, for a consideration. Nothing we were able to say could still their clamour or convince them that we did not require their services. "We were Buddhist monks," we protested. "We were quite capable of worshipping the Buddha ourselves." They took absolutely no notice. "We are Brahmins," they chorused, jumping down off the altar and grabbing us by the arm. "We are the priests here. We will make all the offerings. We will pray to God for you. How much will you pay us?" In circumstances like these, it was not easy to concentrate on the great golden figure in the background, or to feel that I was in the place where the Buddha had gained supreme enlightenment. Had it not been for the Tibetan pilgrims, indeed, I might not really have felt it at all, and my most vivid memories of that first visit to Bodh Gaya would have been of evading the clutches of mercenary Brahmin priests and consecrating boundary walls. As it was, the Tibetans were my salvation. They were poor, they were ragged, they were dirty, and the other pilgrims looked down on them. But they had walked all the way from Tibet, some of them with babies on their backs, and now they came shuffling in through the gate with their prayer wheels and rosaries in their hands, and expressions of ecstasy on their upturned faces. For them, history did not exist. They knew nothing about the Mahant, nothing about the management of the temple. They did not even see the Brahmins. As they circumambulated the temple, as they prostrated themselves before the diamond throne, as they lit butter lamps round the Bodhi tree, they saw only the naked fact of the Buddha's supreme enlightenment. And through their eyes, even if not with my own, I could see it too.